when the tape ended, you were talking about your husband's experience in OSS and 1947.
And right. Actually, it must have been in 45 or earlier, because, as I say, he used to conduct these prison interviews before we met. In fact, I found that very interesting when we first met. You know, we met on a blind date. So in any case, Bruce was something of a specialist on propaganda. And he was specifically assigned to find the propaganda big shots and interview them, mm-hmm. which he did.
Yeah.
And
he interviewed Goebbels' henchmen. Huh?
Well, yes. Goebbels was not available, but mm-hmm. some people at the working level. These were upper bureaucracy, sort of, basically, the ones mm-hmm. that they were experts in propaganda, but they were not politicians mm-hmm. like Goebbels.
Was he at Nuremberg?
No.
Okay.
No.
We're talking about his work in interviewing and looking for...
Yeah. Yes. So when he came back from Germany, he had briefly a research job at the University of Chicago, which was his alma mater. He was undergraduate at Pomona and PhD, University of Chicago. And he also had this interdisciplinary bent. He was there long enough. He was there on a Carnegie grant to put together a social science abstracts journal. I mean, he devised, it still exists. I think it still exists. Last time I looked, it did. And after that, he got a job in the State Department, which had at that time an advanced training institute called the Foreign Service Institute. And he taught international relations at the Foreign Service Institute. And
where was that located?
In Washington, in the State Department building. And we lived in Bethesda, Maryland, and I worked at a research outfit at American University called the Bureau of Social Science Research, where I worked on survey research. And why did this come up? How he came to MSU. This is also actually really part of the history of the era rather than of Michigan State. While he was working at the Foreign Service Institute and I was working at American University in research, the McCarthy era descended. And people in the State Department had just an absolutely miserable time, especially people like Bruce who were he was not extremely left-wing, but definitely liberal, you know, mm-hmm. and definitely Democrat rather than Republican. And in any case, he was absolutely terrified. And, you know, we saw several of our friends go down by being dragged through the mud, and though they were cleared, ultimately their careers were ruined, you know. Mm-hmm. So Bruce desperately wanted to get out of there. But he just, about that time, the decision was taken from him because the Eisenhower administration decided on reductions in force in the State Department and the Foreign Service. And it also wanted to turn all over things to private enterprise. You know, we've been doing this for a long time.
Republican.
So. These reductions in force, they were called. People got RIFT, that was the language for it.
You know? R-I-F-F-E-D.
R-I-F-E-D, yeah, mm-hmm. RIFT, right. Reduced in force, RIFT. So they abolished the Foreign Service Institute on the ground that it should be turned back to private enterprise, meaning, you know, send them to Harvard or send them to Michigan State. You know, you don't have to have a specialized training institute in... So here he was, or here we were, and it wasn't that he couldn't find another job instantly because there were other government jobs. You know, the Air Force had an intelligence outfit that really made considerable efforts to get him. By this time, he was terrified. He wasn't going to work for the government ever again. Mm-hmm. If they allow, you know, if things like McCarthy could happen, mm-hmm. he wanted no part of it. So we were still trying to decide what to do, and one day in the morning the phone rang in Bethesda, and a man from Michigan State University said, our international relations man just dropped dead, and somebody said you might be available. And it was about July or August, you see, for September school year. So Michigan, and Bruce was such a snob, he used to talk about the Middle West when he talked about the Midwest.
The Midwest.
Yes. He was a terrible snob. He was an elitist in the nasty sense, you know. So he came, and we came. And that's how I came to Michigan State University.
And what year was that? Do you remember the...
40, he came in 54. He came in 54.
Okay.
And I came between Christmas 54 and New Year's 55. So, here I was in 1955, but I still had brought with me a job. I was doing a huge book-size annotated bibliography on international communication and propaganda. And this was a contract with the RAND Corporation, which in those days was much more, you know, government-oriented than it is now. Mm-hmm. The RAND Corporation is a sort of a highbrow, basically not just defense. It started as a highbrow defense research outfit. Mm-hmm. Now it does other things too. So in any case, I had that, but being a hopelessly gregarious person, a job that involved just sitting at home or in the library just wasn't enough fun. So to cut a long story short, there was a man, a colleague of my husband's in political science, whom I had met at a convention once. And we had one of those, you know, typical convention flirtations. And he was very amused that I suddenly showed up here as the wife of this new colleague. But he was plugged in various places, including University College, a basic college. He was a friend of the chairman of the social science department. And he mediated this business of one course, on a strictly what we would call a temp these days, you know, a temp teach one course. The guy needed somebody badly, and Leroy Ferguson, my friend, vouched for me. And so Walter Fee hired me for this one course, and then I went for years, but then pretty soon I had three courses a year, and year after year, you know, it became a permanent temporary job. And I loved it. I mean, I really enjoyed myself. This was my other experience of interdisciplinary work, you see, because the social science department was that. And I got involved in editing our common readings and so forth. In those days, that's what we did. We edited our own readings books. And I don't think... Anyway, I think it was a good idea. And at the time, they seemed not so good. But now they seem to me like damn good books that we put together. So I was very much settled in the social science department. And I went away. Oh yes, and that's where the question of promotion came up, because I was a permanent temporary instructor, mm-hmm. you see. And the pressures began about, you know, I ought to be promotable, and but I had to get a PhD, and I said no, until we took that year off and we went to Indonesia and decided I will do this. And so now I'm back where I was before. Mm-hmm. I've been teaching for years. I'm, I guess, well regarded as a teacher because there were enough people not only in the university college but in the provost office who wanted me to get this obstacle out of the way, you know. Get the machine. I forget about the machine. I didn't do it until we came back, and I thought it would be fascinating to be the person who would unify the social sciences. Apropos of an application that required it, I should tell you that I'm really, while I like playing with theory, and I do it reasonably well, I basically don't like theory as a Ding an sich, as, you know, as an intrinsic thing. Mm-hmm. I like it the better to do applied research, you know, and mm-hmm. applied writing. I mean, theory to me is it's a device to assist in doing more insightful interpretations of facts. See what I mean? Okay. Anyway, I was going to cobble together the series so that I could then find out what I really wanted to know is whether you could, whether you had to throw the baby out with the bathwater when you modernized a wonderful, rich, lovable, traditional culture. And that involved systematizing the interactions between social, political, economic, you know, religious. Mm-hmm. So I worked on this quite happily, but with increasing frustration. I used to have rolls of paper on the floor where I had diagrams. You know, the children were not allowed to walk on this part of the dining room because of my...
That's where your research was spread out.
I had to, since I never really was any good at mathematical logic, mm-hmm. I had to do it in terms of visual graphic things, you know, the theoretical convolutions. So, in any case, one, I said, I've got to just either do or die. So Bruce went off and took the children on vacation to Jamaica. I didn't go. Jamaica was the closest we could come to Indonesia, you know, that was in terms of atmosphere and mm-hmm. looks and feel and so on. And I said, I will just simply break the back of this while you're gone, no distractions. And when they came back, I announced to Bruce, it cannot be done. I have had a really major breakthrough. And I now know that what I am trying to do cannot be done in the current state of the particular social sciences. They will have to evolve a lot more highly before one can begin to do a genuine systematization of the whole lot. Mm-hmm. You know? So I felt basically liberated. I to hell with the PhD, to hell mm-hmm. with the dissertation. Then I got recruited from University College and became one of the founding fathers, mothers, parents of James Madison College. And there I was given a highly visible job, which began to raise questions about, you know, where's the PhD? I was chairman of a team that taught the required freshman course, which means the whole first year for three terms our freshmen had to, this was non-negotiable, they all had to take the same, what was essentially an introduction to the social sciences, you see. And one term was primarily sociological, one primarily economic, one primarily political. And the boys who taught were in these disciplines, from these disciplines. But I was the coordinator. Today we don't call such people chairman or director. Mm-hmm. I was the coordinator in modern parlance of this course. But it was a very tightly knit group. I had about variously between 5 and 7 young men, half of whom had just got their PhD and half of them were still working on it. Oh, this was, I think, probably the most productive job I ever had. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I haven't spoken with anyone who was at the founding of James Madison.
Oh, yes.
Who was the driving force behind that concept? Or
Herb Garfinkel. Okay. Herb Garfinkel was a fiercely anti-communist social democrat from New York. He had a New York accent. You know, he came from a almost sort of a comic book Jewish background. And like a lot of these New York intellectuals were just tremendously socially involved and dedicated and so forth. Well, Herb Garfinkel, he had done his dissertation on some labor, political labor issue, and he was a member of the poli-sci faculty. And the now this is sort of important. Now we're really into serious university history. There was in the air, this was in the mid-60s, there was in the air a tremendous amount of breastbeating and soul-searching about the massification of university education and the search for the small college atmosphere, for the direct links between students and individual students and teachers, the sort of broadly conceived interaction and role modeling and support and whatnot. It was in the air all over the university, the search for new models that would take the curse off mass education. That's what it was. And the residential college was again being discussed nationally, but in Michigan State this discussion became quite intensive. The residential college as a way of serving that goal. The idea was that if you studied and lived and ate in the same place and your faculty had their offices there too, this would help reduce the scale, you know, of the unit in which you get educated. And Herb Garfinkel was a very active politician. He was a good lobbyist for this. And there were several other people, the guy Justin Morrill, who was perhaps the most brilliant of them in terms of the vision. Wait a minute, now his name will come to me.
Was it Carlin?
No, Carlin was okay, but Carlin was an ordinary guy. He was not a great man. But this guy who founded Justin Morrill College, he had a sort of Grand Rapids Dutch name. I will have to go do something about these names. The point is, it was in the air, and there were other serious and fairly prominent people in the university who were pressing for these residential colleges. Herb Garfinkel was the one, and they were going to have one for each of the disciplinary groups, you see, not connected at all to university college, but as a formula for these residential colleges. They were going to have four for people who were primarily interested, who were majoring in one of these disciplinary sets. And so Lyman Briggs was the science one, Justin Morrow was the artsy, English, history, languages. James Madison was the social science one. There was never an ATL equivalent that was subsumed in the Justin Morrow model. And with tremendous energy, these people piloted this through, and they got the university approval process to approve it, you know, starting with committees and going through the academic council, well, through the educational policies or academic policy committee, and then the board of trustees. It was a long time a coming, but Herb Garfinkel was the man who invented James Madison College, who piloted, you know, who was the midwife of it, and who was the first dean, the founding dean. And Herb Garfinkel, I only knew because, you know, as a faculty wife, I went to poli-sci parties. We had no other source of mutual acquaintance. But he knew from those occasions what I was doing in social science. And he proceeded to recruit me. And I said, why should I do this? I'm so happy where I am. But he was a great salesman. I mean, you know, his family probably sold garments in the garment district. Uh-huh. And so I went to James Madison College and was there the first, you know, with the founding set of students and faculty. And one of the students in that founding said, Teresa O'Sullivan is now a well-known lawyer on the faculty at Stanford who appears on TV quite often. And this Teresa O'Sullivan, whose name I happen to remember, was a big man on campus in terms of student governance, and is today a major figure nationally. The other major figure that I can think of in terms of Madison students that was the miracle crop of 1977, which contained both Mary Norton and Mike McConnell. Mary Norton was the first female Rhodes Scholar in the history of the Rhodes Scholarship. And by this time, she was, my daughter always says, I trained her from a pup, because I first had her as a student, a favorite student at Madison, then I made my transition to the Honors College, and by the time she showed up as a candidate, I was on the interviewing committee in the Honors College, the committee that recommended her, and she went to Oxford and came back. Then she married Mike McConnell, who was the most conservative, prissy, arrogant, and brilliant student at Madison. He came from a miraculous cohort. Mary was extraordinarily good. He was brilliant. A couple of other really brilliant people in that group. I don't know how you could have this statistical flukes of having them all in 1 year. You know, there was a 10-year supply of super brilliant students that year. And Mike McConnell is now one of those controversial nominations to the Federal Appeals Court that the Bush administration is trying to get up its courage to submit now that the approval process has been taken over by the Democrats. This conservative who is on Bush's list. The question is, will he make it? But Mike McConnell went and became a faculty member at the University of Chicago Law School, which is a very prestigious one. And then one day, I couldn't imagine why this happened, it turns out he is in the law school at the University of Utah. Utah? After this, you know, spectacular history he had and record he had made. Ah, but
Orrin Hatch.
Orrin Hatch, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And he and Michael, I think, plotted this, you see, that they would get him on the Supreme Court in easy stages. I don't know this. I keep forgetting there's this tape. I have no idea that they plotted it, but why would Michael go to? I asked him, I saw him briefly, or Mary, somebody. I said, what in the world possessed you? And they claim it was because they wanted to protect their children from these nasty, modern, lousy influences. And
Utah was a haven?
In Utah, at least they would be properly, wouldn't be threatened with, you know, lousy values in the schools. Which, stretching it a bit, because while Michael is, I suppose, a churchgoer, Mary, who was a flaming agnostic, became an obedient Anglican when she married him. And so he has had always a religious commitment, but the way Anglicanism is, you know, you keep it in its place, it doesn't become a flaming central public part of your life. So there's something very funny about going to Utah, and I think it had to do with facilitating the business of Orrin Hatch as a sponsor for his...
So McConnell and Hatch were were united in their conservative view. That's what brought them
exactly, exactly. Michael became, again, he would show up on TV when there was, on public TV frequently, when mm-hmm. there was one of those issues on which they would have a conservative legal opinion and a liberal legal opinion. Mm-hmm. He has done a number of these, you know, so he's a sort of a semi-public figure in this sense. And then I'm really very, very proud of him because the part about his conservatism and his arrogance, my children hated him. You know, he would come to the house once in a while. But anyway, I can't say these things because if this ever turns up in the public record and then Michael come and listen to it,
well, it's part of his career at Michigan State.
Oh, dear, I really must be careful.
So you had an important influence on him as a mentor, as a teacher?
I had a minor influence.
Minor, okay.
I did have, yes. Mm-hmm. I had him in class, and he would come and give me arguments. Mm-hmm. Always impeccably polite, but he would come to my office. He would not try to have confrontations in class uh-huh. during questions or arguments in class. He would wait, and then he would show up during my office hour and said, you know, what you said was awfully interesting, and I agree with a lot of it, but how could you possibly say da-da-da-da in view of something, something, you know. So we had, this, of course, what Madison was really intended to do, mm-hmm. this kind of interaction was supposed to be part of this holy grail that we were all chasing mm-hmm. in student interaction, you know. So I knew him that way, and many years later, no, this is part of the university history, I'll go through that later, this is important, but it's really more part of something else. We were talking about James Madison, we were talking about notables, right, mm-hmm. that were produced by that college. Mike McConnell is the one that will probably be most prominent over the next decade of the ones I can think of. But, you know, they're scattered about there. Again, I'd have to do a little thinking to dredge up some of the others. But this law school business is no accident. That the two I remember is Terry Sullivan, the first year Madison founding cohort student, who, as I said, is a very influential law professor, and I think she's at Stanford. Teresa Sullivan, she was known as Terry mm-hmm. Sullivan, and she was the first student that really had an impact in the academic council. I mean, she was so good that she could meet the faculty on its own ground. You know, when we first added students, it was done as a sort of craven political expedient mm-hmm. that was during the student.
To give representation in the 60s.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But Teresa was the first student where a lot of scoffers said, well, you know, if they were all like that, they'd be worth having. Mm-hmm. But she went to law school, and Mike McConnell went to law school because James Madison always had that dual set of academic objectives. They're closely related. They were going to train people on a multidisciplinary social science base for graduate schools and careers in public service. That was the intent. And that sort of bifurcated quite early on into, on the one hand, federal and state government. And we have somebody very, very brilliant somewhere hiding as a super expert in the Food and Drug Administration. You know, this business of the public, never mind, forget it. Back to the main line. This is a function of age, you know. I'm 78, and the idea of staying on a single track without constantly branching mm-hmm. through, you know, a myriad recollections.
Yeah.
It really is a certifiably geriatric trait. Mm. You know?
Well, but the other thing is the breadth and length of your career and your knowledge of the institution, which we're trying to tap and capture, you have a lot to say. So don't be afraid to, if a train of thought comes, we can continue to talk about that. But really, what you're talking about in James Madison and how important that was, that development was, both on the students and also on the institution, I think is critical. Right.
And these two tracks, you know, that there were people there who were budding public officials. Mm-hmm. And the other was, it became a very super stupendous, brilliant kind of pre-law program. Mm-hmm. And this is due to two men, one of whom is no longer here, he's somewhere in Texas. The other is still here, Richard Zinman, who is the philosophy man, the political philosophy guy in Madison. And it was the vision of Jack Painter, his friend who is now in Texas, and Zinman, who's still here. Was their vision basically what a really superbly trained elite legal mind ought to have by way of undergraduate preparation? And